Oh, good. We're in studio here today with a local author, and that's Joe Sicardo. But Joe's not just a local author. He's retired from the Massachusetts State Police, a captain and detective. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Oh, you're more than welcome. I really look forward to this.
Oh, terrific. And, you know, I read through not all your book, but a lot of it. There's a lot of information. I felt like I was stepping into a time machine of another time. Before we get into the book, tell me a little bit about your background, but tell me a little bit about what you did and why you started to put together this book.
Well, coincidentally enough, my career spanned the same years of what was going on in Boston, 67, 68, right up until the 90s, that the Winter Hill Gang, who was the wholly owned subsidiary of the Angiulos, which was the mafia in Boston, and they the hierarchy was that they answered to Raymond Patriarca in Providence. But in any event, we were all trying to do the best we could. I was in an organized crime unit. We were chasing bookies, and we were probably paying too much attention to the bookies, but they were affiliated with organized crime. We found out on the South Shore, we did a wiretap. 1976, when I say we, John Namovich and I, and the bookies were paying rent, and so we really extorted. They were being extorted. So there were murders going on around us. As a matter of fact, when we arrested John Monterano in 76, he committed a murder that year in December. These are all things that are unknown to us. And when I say us, the state police, the Boston police, but things were happening, and it's already more than public knowledge that Steve Fleming and Bulger, Jimmy Bulger, were informants for the FBI. But it's knowledgeable now, but it wasn't then.
You know, it's interesting. The title of your book is Capable, and I think this is published through Mascot Books.
Yes.
Reading through it, it's all like you almost need a scorecard, because when you look through this, it's like, my question is, who was running the city? Was it the Boston police, the FBI, the state police, the Irish mob, the Italian mob, the bookies? It's like something out of the Wild West, but it was right in Boston.
The FBI.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's good to know.
They had control.
Okay.
They had two good informants. They were, Steve once told his son, Billy, I think it was Steve Fleming, that they run the city. And Billy told me this because I'm very familiar with the Fleming family, the two sons, Stephen and Billy, and the common-law wife, Marion. So they were running the city, the FBI, and they got acquiesced to in the sense that John Morris took a bribe. He took $7,000. He was the second, the SAC, special agent in charge of the organized crime unit. They call it C3. And John Conley was taking money also, and he went to prison for 8 or 9 years on federal corruption charges, RICO. And they allowed these two gentlemen in their gang, as it were, in Winter Hill, to do what they wanted to do. But by the same token, the Winter Hill was affiliated, like I said, with the Angiulos. Now, I don't think the Angiulos for 1 minute thought that those two guys, Steve and Jim, were informants. And when I say I can back up the fact that the Winter Hill was a subsidiary in 1980, the state police did an investigation in Lancaster Street off of the north end. You could walk to the Angiulos headquarters from there. And all they did, they put a bug in a garage, and all of the wise guys from the north end were coming and going at all times of the day, as were Steve and Jimmy and other guys that were with Winter Hill. The only guy that never showed up was Monterano, because he was a fugitive at the time. He screwed in 79 and was arrested in 95. And I sort of break off in the book, not to get into that aspect of things, where I do write a lot about the murders that he was involved in. So in 79, I had a sort of step back, but he did commit two murders in 81 and 82 for Bulger and Fleming. That was Roger Will, the executive for the Miami High Line, and John Callahan, who was a president at one time of that High Line. And they murdered those guys because Fleming and Bulger and Monterano wanted to get the skim the parking receipts from the Fonton down in Miami.
Because I was going to ask you, most of the stories that we cover, I guess in general, if it's a major crime, it either stems from lust or greed or both. When you talk about the mobster life in the city of Boston and some of the cops or federal agents who were also compromised, what was the business they were running? What was it? Prostitution, drugs? What was it?
Everything. They were extorting all the bookies, and I put in the book that I never met a bookie I didn't like, and there was one that had a gun on his coffee table when we hit him. And they were extorting them. They were long sharkers. They were doing, and I talked to, I've been in communications with Steve Fleming for about 10 years off and on while he's in prison in Otisville, New York. And one question I asked him was on the phone. I said, because I was interested in the this Gardner theft, $500 million worth of art. And I said, who did it? He said, well, you know what we did, Joe, because we were on a first-name basis. And he said, Jimmy and he, they shook the trees in the city of Boston and going after all the wise guys, everybody they could, and they couldn't come up with it. So that's what they would do. If they thought there was a score somewhere, okay, minimally, mm-hmm. money-wise, they would go after it. So that was their modus operandi. Mm-hmm. And they shook everybody down. And Jimmy had the reputation that if you didn't play ball, you're gonna get killed.
Two names that come up, two themes and two names that come up multiple times in your book: Margaret Sylvester, John Martirano. Why are these two people so important to you?
Because I profile six women that got killed during this period. Three of them were solved murders: Debbie Davis, Debbie Hussey, and I think of the other one. But there are other women that the murders didn't get solved, and one is Frances Mansfield in South Boston in 1989. But Margaret Sylvester, I have a copy, probably more of a rough intelligence of John Martirano's debriefings. The first thing that they talk to him about is this, or he talks about, is Margaret Sylvester, and she was murdered in his father's after-hour joint called Luigi's, his father's Angie. And that was over the intermission lounge in Combat Zone. I know you used to hang out there, but in any event, I did go there for a couple of drinks once.
Woo!
So in any event, in the debriefing of Martirano, he sort of asserts that Steve's brother, Jim, or Vinny, goes by both, Vincenzo, Flemmy, and this guy, Jack Azzulli, former Boston cop who went bad. He was a leg break, and a guy named Palladino and Jackson had participated in the murder of Margaret Sylvester because, according to Martirano, she was having an affair with his father. That was a family business. Mom used to be there, Mrs. Mm-hmm. Martirano, the two brothers, Jimmy and John. At that point in 1964, 65, he had already killed a few people, being Martirano, John Martirano. So they took the body and put it in a loft upstairs, and somebody called the Boston Police Department. And this is just one quick one, mm-hmm. That on a pretext that there was stolen goods up in the loft, mm-hmm. and they found the body of Marcus Sylvester. And they got Jimmy Martirano because he cleaned the scene, I guess, was pretty bad, pretty bloody. And he took the rug and bought a new one. That's how he got convicted of accessory after the fact, and he did about 3 to 5 years for that. But there was a woman, Patricia Caldwell, who recanted her testimony from the grand jury to the trial of Jimmy Martirano, and she got grabbed for perjury and so on. So that was just, again, my theory being, that nobody, there's three words in life, they're all four letter, care, work, and you come up with the other one. Mm-hmm. Nobody cared, and nobody wanted to really do the work. And I did a lot of research with the Boston Police unsolved murder squad, and they were pretty good to me. That file's missing. And I have a suspicion that the U.S. Attorney's Office had it, because they, in fact, with the DEA and the state police, they debriefed John Martirano. And the other women was, Frances Mansfield and Kathy Murphy. Martirano was indirectly involved with both those murders. Kathy Murphy was a Dorchester girl, Franklin Field Projects, was living with her mother. Her dad was dead for about 6 years before she got involved. And she had a menial job at Boston Mutual Insurance Company. She used to go to these after-hour places on Dudley Street on the periphery of Dorchester and Roxbury. And she knew Steve Flemmy and the Bennett brothers. Mm-hmm. And she got a ride home one night, and somebody killed her. And coincidentally to that, there was a car stolen from the same area of where she lived on Ames Street in Franklin Field, off of Franklin Field. And that car was found 15, 20 minutes later up in the expressway, northbound lane, right off of the Mass Ave exit. And what I could never find out was whether they did it with a master key or they broke the ignition. The reason being, one of the suspects in that murder of Kathy Murphy was a guy named Jimmy Kearns. And two months later, he got arrested with a couple of other guys. One is Big Billy Kelly, I call him, and Jimmy Kearns. They were found with 150 master keys to cars. So witnesses, according to the Boston police reports and whatnot, that they do have a file for, said there was two men in a car. And when they heard Kathy yell, oh, no, oh, no, and then she got shot. So those are two murders, again, that people don't really... It's going on to a certain degree today. If you were affiliated with some wise guy or something like that, and, you know, as a female, that I don't know if they put the same amount of care into the investigation.
You seem like you've got a lot of compassion, and I can still see that it's not just something you talk about. It's something that you still feel a little bit about. Can't say that all people that work in law enforcement can completely compartmentalize that and just put that on the side. Why did you write the book? Was it to have a record of all these things that happened, or do you want to make sure that some things are not forgotten?
I started to do research on the John Namovich trial. He was a trooper that we were very friendly with. So I went over to Trapello Road. There were federal archives in Waltham, and I asked them for the case file on the trial. And I started going through it all, and I'm finding stuff, and I was absolutely livid when I saw some stuff that I found, and I put it in the book. And I said, this is wrong. The FBI, as I put in the book, framed him. So that sort of got me on to other initiatives, checking more into names that I heard or I saw. Judge Wolf had a 661-page report on a hearing did after what they call U.S. Government versus Frank Salemi back in the middle, 97, 98, 99. And I went through all that, read that, and I read all these other things. I'm seeing these names pop up, like the females that I just talked about. Mm-hmm. And I'm seeing that, you know, this never heard any real good reporting on this by those that are supposed to be good reporters in the Boston newspapers. So that's when I got very interested. I started, I made a contact in the homicide squad, unsolved homicides, and I saw files, things that I'd never seen before or never heard about. And I just kept going and going and going. People started giving me things that I had, under ordinary circumstances, I wouldn't have been able to get it myself, mm-hmm. research mm-hmm. documents. And then I went in and went to the several areas that I found documents. And every time I get more documents, I'm getting deeper and deeper into it. And, you know, I had to process those documents and figure out how I'm going to write about it. Then I'd get something else. And it just, I said... You know, I just got to keep going. Oh, that's yeah. why I put so much in the book. There was so much to read or talk about.
This is packed with information. And, you know, it's tough with all the nicknames because I was thinking about that Beatles song, Rocky Raccoon. What was it they say? Her name was McGill. She called herself Lil, but everyone knew her as Nancy. Everybody's got a nickname, or they go by this name, and they're known by this. But
that's what I like, is the anecdotal information. By the same token, I try to stay away from a bunch of names, because every time you put a name in, you got to explain who it is.
Right.
So, you know, I could put another 100 names in there, including cops.
Well, and good, you know, cops. And if the book is capable, and it's mascotbooks.com. Yeah. Is that the best way to...
Mascotbooks.com, yep.
That's the best way to get...
Yeah, that's the best. And you
get a copy of that. Now, let me ask you a question, too. I always thought to be like in the mob or the Cosa Nostra or mafia or whatever you want to call it, I thought you had to be a full-blood Italian. It looks like there's a lot of Irish guys. Can you be a made man if you're not Italian?
No, you can't. First of all, Monterano's mother was Irish.
Okay.
So he wasn't going to make it, all right?
Okay.
Jimmy somehow, his brother got involved with the mafia on the West Coast. There's no such thing as the mafia on the West Coast. They're all Hollywood.
They're all in Hollywood.
Yeah, exactly. They're not New York
all the producers.
Mafias. Yeah. So they were her maiden name was Hunt. So they were never going to get made.
Okay.
So they had their own affiliation, their own gang. Now, Stevie Fleming, his mother's maiden name is Misserville. And I don't know quite sure where that genealogy comes from, because I ran it and it could be Italian. All mm-hmm. right. And of course, Jimmy Bulger is never going to get made in the mob. And that's, you know, they had their own thing going. Jimmy McDonald, Jimmy Sims, these were all Somerville guys. Howie Winter, which mm-hmm. is not named after him, is Winter Hill Mob as a section in Somerville. And, you know, they were pretty vicious guys. They were all started with the Buddy McLean and the McLaughlins way back when, in the 50s and 60s, where they were all longshoremen. They were vying for power in different areas with regards to criminality. Hijackers. They did a lot of hijackers, that crew.
Why did the feds make a deal with John Martirano? What did they get out of that?
Well, what happened was he was in prison right here nearby at Plymouth House of Correction. And can I tell you a quick story with regards to Fleming being down there? My son's a marshal. He was a deputy marshal. He's retired. So his job at the time back in the 90s after Fleming got arrested in 95 was to bring him back and forth from the House of Correction in Plymouth to the courthouse in Boston. Make a long story short, they're in the zip lane heading south back to the jail. And somebody rear-ended him, and right at the end of the zip lane in Braintree, him and his partner jumped out with guns. They didn't know what was going on because Stevie Fleming was in the back seat of the car. In any event, it was a fireman that shouldn't have been in that lane because it's supposed to be two or more people. And, of course, Stevie's in the back and yelling, "Oh, my back," and all this. They took him to the hospital. You know what Steve said to him? He said, "Joe, I never would do that to you," because they thought that somebody was going to try to get him free. But anyhow, the Mataranos, in relationship to whether they can get in or not, no, their own gangs were doing better, I think. The mafia in Boston and Jewish, they were great at the numbers, okay? When I say the numbers, the lottery, which is today known as the lottery. They were good at loan sharking. They were good at sports betting, all right? But these other guys, they weren't good at so much as extortions. Like they probably extorted millions of dollars, Bulger and Fleming. And they themselves, in my opinion, probably got racked up with $10 million in their own wealth. And Stevie was having he had a businesses on the side. He was making money straight up, where Bulger had to wait until they won the lottery way back when. And that's what his form of income was, $80-something thousand a year.
But what
did I answer your question?
Yeah, but what did the U.S. attorney, why did he cut a deal? Well, people say they cut a deal with the devil. What did the U.S. attorney
Mataranos get out? Mataranos turned after 3 years of being in the same House of Corrections as Steve. He found out through the hearings with Judge Wolf, and I got to give the attorneys on that, Cardinale, forced the issue somehow or other. Anthony, he was, I think it was Salemi's attorney at the time. And that's when he said, "This is it. I'm going to get them before they get me," meaning Mataranos. So he went to the U.S. attorney's office, and his attorney, I think, was Frank Demento, good friend Demento and Sullivan. They were a great criminal law firm back then. And he gave everything up. They being the DEA, Dan Daugherty and the state police, interviewed him, and they got all this. So Bulger was on the lam, so all he had to do was worry about Steve Fleming, because he was in jail with him. So he beat Fleming to the immunity. He won the immunity race.
Okay, so that was.
And they, after reading those debriefings, I'm not impressed with some of the stuff that the debriefers didn't ask Mataranos. And I'm reading it, and I'm saying to myself, why didn't they do this? Why didn't they do that? And one example is that Mataranos killed three people one night, and he says he got there, killed them, and he left. It doesn't say how he got there. Who drove him? Did he drive? All right, and he was going to go to Steve Fleming's house to go get a coat. And can I talk? You want to talk about that one? That's one murder, that three people, two collateral damages, 1968. Steve Fleming tries to collect a debt in the Basin Street South, which was owned by the Mataranos family, pretty much. Two wise guys, legit, Rocco Lamantina and Sincotta, beat up Steve to try to collect this, who was trying to collect this debt. And this guy, Herbie Smith, held the arms of Fleming. Stevie told Mataranos. Mataranos says, "I'll take care of that." January 1968, 3 o'clock in the morning, he has a pretextual meeting with this guy. They're going to go to a card game. Herbie Smith, he gets in the back seat of the car right behind Herbie. Boom, boom, hits Herbie right in the temple, kills him. And there was a young girl, Elizabeth Dixon, 19 years old. She was in the front seat. He hit one right through her left temple. And next to Mataranos was a kid, Dougie Barrett, 17, went through his left temple, out his head, and smashed the glass. He says in his debriefing that he left there and heading to Mataranos. I put on the book, here's this overweight white guy in a minority neighborhood with blood all over him trying to get a cab. Who's going to pick him up at 3? And that didn't happen. But one thing that I did, according to the debriefing of Mataranos, he took the ignition keys. So I went to the Boston PD. I said, "Can I see the file?" And sure enough, there were no keys in the ignition. That's the only truth to that, other than the killing these three people.
And with all the experience that you had dealing with a lot of action here with a lot of these guys on the wrong side of the law, did anyone ever try to corrupt you?
If they did, I didn't know about it.
Okay.
No. I got to answer straight out, no. We see, the state police is a little bit different than local PDs. We're not as closely aligned with the neighborhoods that a lot of local, mm-hmm. I'm not saying local PDs are taking corruption, but in the FBI, on the other hand, they did get compromised certain agents, mm-hmm. not all. And I worked with a lot of good people back in the day. I mean, go out and have a couple of cocktails after work. There was never an issue, never a problem.
Right.
But I did watch, well, no, they didn't, nobody, I don't think of anybody, you know, that try to corrupt me in particular. We only had a couple of guys in my career that did get corrupted. It was only like two or three at the time, and there was 700-800 troopers at that time.
What about during your career? Is there one story that you still hold with you that you wish you had done more with or could do more with, or something that they say, I'm not going to use the word haunt, but is there anything that you still think about or maybe even work on that sticks with you today?
Yeah, I couldn't find Debbie Hussey. She was dead. And that haunts me because Marion, how can I say, through her younger sister, who was very good friends with my wife growing up in Neponset and Dorchester, I went and saw her. She was in a coffee shop working in Quincy. And the first thing she says to me, are you wired? And another compliment I got, she said, you're the same. You're just like Stevie, except you're a cop. But I understood her. She was a Dorchester gal, you know. I'm from Dorchester. We, you know, these are mm-hmm. sarcasms that are very predominant in the culture. But in any event, so I went all out at first, and I got to find her. But she wouldn't let me talk to Steve. She said, if he knows about this, God only knows what's going to happen to her. Mm-hmm. So I had no choice not going to him. So I used every other mechanical device that I could use. And I talked to this gal that was friendly with Debbie. I got all her records and arrest records and so on and so forth. And then, 19, so this was, I get my times mixed up, but a couple of years later, I had a trooper at the AG. I said, run everything you can. I was still into it, but I'm still not finding her. And we found a girl in California, Debbie, and who matched our Debbie's description. Not only that, her month and day of birth was the same as one of the Fleming kids. But anyhow, I got her a copy of her driver's license. At the time, California had thumbprints on their licenses, and I matched them with Debbie's thumbprint. And told Marion, she called the girl. I said, you're going to be disappointed, it's not her. And as it turns out, it wasn't, and she had already been dead and was buried off in Neponset in Dorchester. And that bothers me to the point that I don't know if I should have done more or I should have had more information, but even if I had everything, I wasn't going to find her. She was dead. But what was the good thing about it, if you got 1 second? Marion brought forth, Hussey brought forth, that was her married name, her first husband, and Debbie was the only child by that marriage, wrongful death lawsuit. And because of all of what I was able to do at her urging to find Debbie, I had all the records, I had everything that I had done, and presented them to the federal government as evidence that she, in essence, tried to find her daughter under dubious reasons that she was missing. And there's some kind of statute of limitations on that. And she beat the statute of limitations to get that information out, and she won $300,000. On the other hand, Debbie Davis's family didn't have that, I don't know if you want to call it a luxury, had that information, and they didn't make any money on it because it's this strange statute of limitations.
Well, you know, we're talking with Joe Sicardo here. The name of his book is Capable, and it's really, again, like you're entering a time capsule, a lot of information here. It seems like this is a good record of what happened back in the day. You'd have to go to so many different sources to even put half of this together. One more question. Where did the title come from?
The title came from, there's a few pages in the beginning there, that John Mutterown's debrief in 1998, where he tells the troopers and whatnot that the reason they worked for the Angels, they wanted to prove that they were capable of doing things for the Angels. When you got a wise guy like that, that means they'll kill, and he had already killed for many years, and that's where the capable comes.
And you can get this book at, is it Mascot?
Yes.
Just like a team mascot,
yes.
MASCOT, mascotbooks.com.
Yes.
The author is Joe Sicardo, and the book is capable, and we appreciate you joining us today. What a fascinating story. We could talk for two more hours, but I can't. I'm running out of time here.
Well, first of all, thank you very much for having me, and I think this book is hopefully it'll be a reference material down the road for other police officers, state and otherwise. And again, I just want to reiterate, I work with a lot of good guys in the FBI. I bring them to the test, to the fore, and this one here in the book. With as far as I'm concerned, they framed a trooper, and so they not they, just some specific people.
Thanks again. I'm Christine James, 95.9 WATD.